Miscavige, and today I'm joined by Kevin Beato and Brendan Horoho. We are three history grads from the University at Buffalo, and we are all certified social studies teachers coming to you today to help those of you who are middle school, high school students, or anybody in between who wants an overview of their American history and World History II classes. Today, we are going to be kind of looking at things from the American history perspective, our next episode, our third episode here. And we are going to talk about the American Revolution. So, in the past couple episodes, we talked about European exploration to the Americas. We talked about the English and their establishing of colonies in the Americas. And today we're going to get into the American Revolution. So, first off, Brendan, tell us a little bit about the background to the Revolution and some of the things that were going on in the colonies that maybe led up to it.
So the colonies were kind of forgotten by the British Empire for a while. They were just there making money. They were part of the system of mercantilism where the British were basically turning a huge profit and the colonies were just doing their business and they were working. And everybody was totally fine. The colonies governed themselves. They did their own thing. The British basically left them alone. And this was a period known as like statutory neglect. So the colonists were left to do their own thing. Eventually, this situation starts to change. There's an issue. There's a lot of colonies that are, there are a lot of empires that are fighting for control in North America. So you have the Dutch, you have the English, you have the French, and to some extent you have the Spanish. And so they're fighting for control. And as they start to push against each other, they start to have these conflicts. And that's where we sort of start to get into the French and Indian War.
Yeah, so the French and Indian War, definitely, that's going to be a big thing that's going to bring an end to what you talked about earlier, the salutary neglect, allowing the colonies to sort of do what they wanted and sort of govern themselves. The French and Indian War comes along. And Kevin, why don't you tell us a little bit about the French and Indian War? Who was fighting in this war? What were they fighting over? And then, like, what was the outcome? Like, how does this lead to the British taking more control of the colonies?
So the French and Indian War, it pits Britain and the American colonies and native tribes that are allied to them against the French and the native tribes that are allied to them. And they're typically fighting along the Ohio River Valley, along a series of forts. So in Virginia, the governor issued to the Ohio Company the rights to land in the Ohio Valley to go out and take the land. Problem. Natives live there, and the French are settling there. So they say, no, this is our land. And the French respond by building forts. So then the British start attacking the forts, and now we have the French and Indian War that breaks out. So the war lasts for several years, and actually this war is just one part of a greater war between Britain, France, even Russia's involved, Portugal, Spain, etc. And that's called the 7 Years' War, which is actually interesting because it lasted about 9 years. But ignore that. 7 Years' War it is. History is not always strict on that. So the 7 Years' War is the greater global conflict. The French and Indian War is the part that's taking place in North America. The British and the colonials, led in part by this young up-and-coming officer named George Washington, they end up defeating the French over the course of the war. Now, the British not only win in North America, which then gives them control of French and Spanish territories in the New World, like Florida, but it also they also win abroad, too. I mean, this war was fought, you know, throughout Europe and even as far east as India, this war was going on. And Britain wins, and with that comes a massive amount of debt, about 70 million pounds, that they incurred by fighting this war.
Yeah, definitely. So they win the war, and this is something I always tell my students. They win the war, and for them that's good, right? But it doesn't come without a bit of a consequence, and that consequence is that they needed to have money to be able to fight that war, that 7 Years' War that was actually 9 years. And in order to get that money to be able to buy supplies for their soldiers and pay salaries and pay for the shipment of goods to faraway battlefields and all of that kind of stuff. In order to have the money to do that, the British borrowed that money. And, you know, a quick little aside here. This is something I always kind of tell my students. It's the idea of credit, right? They don't have the money on hand to fight that war at the time. They need to borrow that money, but they also need to make sure that that money gets paid back. The example I use with my students is I say, if a friend came to you and asked you to borrow $5 for lunch, and you let them borrow that money, if they don't pay you back that $5, the next time they come to ask you for $5 for lunch again, you're going to say no. But if they come and they pay you back the next day, and maybe they pay you back a little extra, what we call interest, they pay you $6, well, if they come to you in a couple weeks and ask for $5 again, then you're going to be likely to give it to them because you know that they're trustworthy and you know that you'll probably even make some money off of it. The same goes for governments and for the British in this case. They know they need to pay back this debt because if they don't pay back this debt, if another war comes up in the future and they need to borrow money to fight it, nobody's going to want to let them borrow it because they know they're not going to get it back. So the British have to pay back this debt. And to do that, they are going to bring about an end to salutary neglect. They're going to be stricter with the colonies. And Brendan, why don't you tell us a few things that they did that showed us that they were stricter with the colonies after the French and Indian War?
So the only way a government can really raise money is by raising taxes. You know, you can go to your citizens and you can ask for bonds and those kinds of things, but the number one way that governments raise money is taxes. So the British Parliament, they reason that, okay, we need to raise some money. The colonies were the ones that we were protecting against the French. Let's go ahead and have the colonies help us pay part of this bill. It doesn't sound unreasonable. And so in order to do this, they institute some taxes. The British Prime Minister, George Grenville, persuaded Parliament to pass the Stamp Act and the Sugar Act. So the Sugar Act was in 1764. Basically, it was an act that said, hey, you know, anything that you buy, kind of like sugar or anything that's sweet, you know, if you buy some pastries or whatever, those things are going to be taxed. And so it's just a tiny little sales tax, essentially. The Americans don't really respond too well to this, right? This Sugar Act is passed because it's trying to fix the Molasses Act, which was from 30 years before in 1733. And people basically just went around that. They didn't pay their taxes. They would bribe people in order to get around it. And so the government was like, okay, but this time we really actually need the money. So, you know, let's enforce this this new act. They also passed the Stamp Act, which would require stamps or other printed materials, court documents, land titles, contracts, playing cards, newspapers, anything, any printed item had to have a stamp from the royal government basically saying that it has paid its taxes. Otherwise, you would not be allowed to sell and share those materials. And so with these two massive taxes, you're basically creating these sales taxes that start to suck money out of the colonies. And the colonies, because they had no say in this, because they had no representation in the parliament that passed this new law, they feel like they are being bullied. They are being, you know, forced by the British to pay these taxes when it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to them why they're responsible for it.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things I always kind of bring up with my students is that, yes, the taxes are an issue. Nobody likes to have to pay more for the goods that they're buying because of a tax. It takes more money out of their own pockets. But the bigger issue in all of this is not just the fact that they don't like the taxes, the fact that they don't have any representation. There's nobody there to be involved in this decision-making process and to represent how the colonies feel about it. They don't have anybody to say, yes, we agree, no, we disagree. They're just completely left out of it, almost like you could imagine a parent making a decision for their child without taking into account their child's you know, feelings about it. All right, so how did the colonists respond to all of this?
So the colonies responded by saying, A, we're not going to take it anymore. B, They declared loyalty to Great Britain, but they said, listen, guys, we love you, but if you're going to act like this, we're going to have some problems. And they told the British Parliament that they have no right to tax the colonies, right? Just like you were saying, no taxation without representation. If you go to Washington, D.C., even today, on their license plates, that's the phrase that's written at the top, no taxation without representation. Because for a long time, Washington, D.C., because it's not a state, was not represented in the United States the same way that states are. And so they felt similarly afflicted. One of the things that that the colonies started to do when they were standing up to the British here is they started to organize a little bit. So all the colonies held a Congress in 1765 to decide on the plan of action against the British. Like, so you start to see this democracy. You start to see this union between the colonies grow and flourish.
So, Kevin, what could you tell us about some of the stuff that happened after this kind of anger was starting to develop and the colonies were starting to feel a sense of being taken advantage of by the British?
So the British acknowledged the rejection of the Stamp Act by the colonies and they repealed it, which was viewed as a victory in the colonies. But the British at the same time came out with their Declaratory Act, which said, no, in fact, you're wrong. Taxes in America are treated the same way as in Britain. We have the authority to tax you. So they were celebrating the victory, but they were still upset over the fact that the Crown and Parliament viewed the colonies as subjects that were not deemed worthy of having representation in Parliament. After that, you know, hatred in the colonies started to grow, especially in New England and particularly in Boston. Now, a series of acts did come out following this, which did sort of push the British rule further. So, like, in the mid-60s, 1760s, the Quartering Act was passed, which would be, you know, something that the Founding Fathers would use when they crafted the Bill of Rights. The Third Amendment addresses this. So British soldiers had the right to be, you know, provided candles, bedding, food, drink, etc., in the homes of people in the colonies, which obviously would anger them, having military just come knock on your door and say, oh, and yep, as according to the Quartering Act, we are allowed to just come in here and use your home. So that upset a number of Americans. The Townshend Acts, because the British are still in need of money, it enacted taxes on things like glass, paper, paint, lead, and tea. These new taxes helped found groups like the Sons of Liberty and the Daughters of Liberty, who were dead set against British policies and organized protests against them. The sort of culminating factors I did mention, Boston, probably the most iconic moment, if you will, of this period was in 1770, where essentially the deadliest snowball fight in America happened, when colonists antagonized British soldiers who were on post, and it got to the point where after throwing snowballs, which then turned into rocks and other objects being hurled at them, being taunted, so, you know, daring them to shoot at them, something happened. A soldier fired his gun, the rest fired as well, and five colonists were dead.
Yeah, and it's actually worth noting that the soldiers that were firing upon the British, or that were firing upon the American colonists, they were defended in court, and a lot of them got off and were acquitted of charges thanks to John Adams.
Seven of the nine were acquitted by John Adams.
Yeah, John Adams, who would become the first Vice President of the United States and the second President of the United States after George Washington. So that's an interesting thing. I remember reading about that, and I think his reason for defending these British soldiers was not that he felt kind of any association or loyalty to the British, but rather a lot of other lawyers were not willing to step up to defend them because of the hatred towards the British, and he believed that in order for the justice system to function as it should, everybody deserved to have their, you know, basically their fair trial, and that included having legal representation. So that is why he stepped up, even though he did not really like the British.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, a lot of other lawyers were afraid because people thought that their patriotism was going to be questioned, or people would think that they were siding with the crown. But John, because, you know, everyone knew clearly where he stood, he knew that he could defend them properly in court, and, you know, nobody really would question his loyalty to the colonies.
Yeah, really interesting. So earlier we talked a little bit about, like, unification in the colonies. What was the Great Awakening?
So the Great Awakening was a time period. Well, there were a couple different waves, but the Great Awakening was essentially when there was a religious revival throughout the colonies. And so, you know, Christianity was one of the dominant religions in the colonies, and it just sort of spreads. But as it spreads, it builds a sense of unity and a sense of community among the colonies. So there's mostly Catholics and Protestants living in the colonies, and Protestants in particular read their Bibles in order to stay close to God. If you listen to our World History series, when we talk about Martin Luther and you know, the belief that God's word is, you know, the only thing you can trust. You can't really trust the priests or the popes or anything like that. It sort of highlights that need to be able to read. If you can read your Bible, you can read God's word, and you can stay close with God. So one unintended consequence of this Great Awakening is that Americans' literacy rates start to rise really, really high in the colonies. And so eventually this plays a huge role in the American Revolution, because the printing press helps spread pamphlets all around the colonies. Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense, in which he discussed how it didn't really make sense to have a king. He said, you know, just because, you know, one man is qualified to rule doesn't mean his children will be qualified to rule. And he made a bunch of really good arguments. And because the Americas were very literate, those ideas started to spread like wildfire, and it caused a lot of problems for the British.
Yeah, for sure. And you can even trace back some of those ideas to the Enlightenment. You know, people like John Locke, who argued that we have three natural rights, life, liberty, and property, that can't be taken away, that would be later used by Thomas Jefferson when he writes the Declaration of Independence. Ideas like that of Montesquieu separating the powers of government so you don't have one person or one small group controlling all the power that government has. You know, people like Rousseau, the idea of a social contract and that the government has a responsibility to protect people's natural rights. All of those ideas, which started in Europe, make it to America, and they're widely read in America because of this sort of American tradition of reading that had developed. So, interesting stuff. It's interesting to see how all of that kind of connects to the Revolution. So a couple more things to talk about here. Let's talk about the Tea Act of 1773. What was the deal with that?
So the British East India Company was not in the best shape at this point in time in history. So to help it out, Parliament passed the Tea Act of 1773. This gave the company the right to ship tea to the colonies without paying a lot of the taxes that were usually placed on tea, tea being a very hot commodity both in Britain and in the colonies. And it allowed the company to bypass colonial merchants. So it's selling the tea at a much lower price. So on the surface, you might think the colonists would say, oh, cool, you know, we drink a ton of tea, now it's going to be even cheaper, except it helps to undermine the colonial merchants. So the local merchants are now losing money because now the tea is cheaper. And it's also just another way they view as the Parliament and the Crown to sort of stick it to the Americas and assert their authority over them. So this culminates when later on in 1773, the tea ships arrive at Boston Harbor. And when the tea is going to be unloaded, people like Samuel Adams and stuff, who have spoken out against this, help to organize the Boston Sons of Liberty. And they dress up as Mohawk Native Americans armed with hatchets, and they head down to the wharves, and they board the ships, and they throw almost 350 chests of tea overboard. And this is the famous Boston Tea Party.
Yeah, that was definitely a big act of defiance. They throw all of that tea overboard. It was worth, in today's money, probably millions of dollars.
Yep.
Lost. And this the company that had transported the tea, the British East India Company, a lot of the British leaders in Parliament, a lot of the lawmakers in Parliament actually had stakes in that company. So for them, that was like directly affecting their wealth and their pocketbook. So you can imagine that they are not going to be too pleased with that.
Yeah, and one of the things that's really great to think about here is that the people who were on the docks there watching, you know, John Hancock and Sam Adams and these guys, like, go ahead and just, you know, basically give the middle finger to the British. Everybody knew they weren't Mohawks, you know? I mean, there's no way you could confuse a white guy from the Massachusetts Bay Colony with a Mohawk, right? But they dressed up in these rudimentary disguises, and nobody was willing to snitch or to tell on Hancock and his collaborators.
Yeah, so very interesting. You can see kind of the anger and the protest and the unity all starting to build up in the colonies due to all of this stuff. And I think in our next episode, we can take a look at where things go from here. So we have seen the British win a war. They're in debt. They start cracking down on the colonies and trying to collect money through taxes to pay off that debt. And now we've seen the colonists kind of respond to it, right? They're not exactly getting along. Things are not in good shape. So in the next episode, we're going to take a look at the shot heard around the world and the beginning of the American War for Independence. We're going to take a look at some of the battles and all of that kind of stuff and how we get there. We're getting close. We're not quite there yet, but we will get there in the next episode. So for Brendan, for Kevin, and for myself, thank you for tuning in to Sleeping Through Class, and we look forward to you listening in again next time.